Ladies and gentlemen, we welcome you back to the fourth episode of Behind the 90s. I am your host, Justin Ladano. I thank you for joining us again today. It is a beautiful day to be listening to Behind the 90s. I want to say thank you to all of our wonderful listeners across the globe. We had a fantastic episode 3, a lot of great feedback, a lot of likes. I can't wait to get it started for this episode, folks. Let's get right into it. Let me just set the scene for you here. Close your eyes, even if you're driving, it's okay. Just close them. Let Jesus take the wheel. If you're working, just put it down, close your eyes, relax. We're going to rewind back to a simpler time when movies were held in our hands like little bricks of gold. In the 90s, there was one place you could go to get cheap candy, any movie you wanted, and a whole lot of memories. As soon as you entered this place, smells of popcorn danced in the air. Your eyes were overwhelmed with stories of adventure, romance, and comedy. The background noises echoed with spoilers and recommendations. Which movie should I get? I hear he dies at the end. Actually, turns out she's a robot the entire movie. That's right, folks. I'm talking about your friendly neighborhood Blockbuster store. Started in 1985 in Dallas, Texas, David Cook, the founder and CEO, established a video rental company titled Blockbuster Video. At one time, there was a new Blockbuster opening every 17 hours. In 1994, Viacom purchased Blockbuster for a whopping $8.4 billion. Blockbuster also considered having their own Blockbuster Video Awards, even planned on building a theme park. Man, I wish that happened. There is an old legend that says Blockbuster could have bought Netflix. Netflix and other streaming services eventually caused the demise of Blockbuster around the early 2000s. However, there is still one Blockbuster standing in the United States of America. It is in Bend, Oregon. There has recently been an amazing documentary made about this last Blockbuster. It is called The Last Blockbuster. And we actually have the director of this documentary on our show today. Who better to talk about Blockbuster than a man who makes his own Blockbuster documentary? This documentary is available on YouTube, Google Play, Vudu, Amazon Prime Video, and Apple TV Plus. And on that note, we take you to the interview portion of our show today. Sit back and enjoy. Okay, coming to you live from Behind the 90s, we have our next guest with us. Our next guest was the director of the Last Blockbuster documentary. We are happy to have him here, folks. The one, the only, Taylor Morden from Bend, Oregon. How you doing today, sir?
I'm doing well, Justin. Thanks for having me on the show.
Anytime, sir. Now, with a subject like Blockbuster, I thought to myself, who could I possibly bring in? And then I found your documentary and I watched it and I said, this is my guy. I'm not settling for anyone else.
Well, I appreciate that. I feel like I know a lot about this one Blockbuster, but not all of them. But I do know a bit. And I was certainly a big Blockbuster patron back in the days. I would spend a lot of time browsing the aisles. So seems like a good fit.
Absolutely. That was a huge part of my childhood and so many 90s kids. My first question to you is really, what inspired you to create this documentary? It is so awesome. Walk me through it, my brother.
Well, I appreciate that. And thanks for checking out the movie. So, I mean, just like you said, I'm a 90s kid. I was born in the 80s, but I spent my good years in the 90s. And I loved the video store. You know, I loved renting movies. It was, you know, we didn't have a lot of money, so I'd have to save up to go rent a movie. And it was like a huge deal for me. And I loved the local video store. I loved the big chain Hollywood Video, Blockbuster, any place that wanted to let me watch a movie, because it was before anything was available any other way. If it wasn't on TV, you had to rent it. So that was really formative for me as a movie lover and a pop culture fan of the 90s. And then flash forward, God, 25 years. How old are we now? Oh my goodness. But about 5 years ago, I was living in Washington, D.C., and I moved back here to Oregon with my wife to kind of get away from the big city life. And this small town of Bend, I would drive around and I would see this sign that said Blockbuster Video. And this was 2015, 2016. And I knew Blockbuster went out of business, just like everybody knew Blockbuster went out of business. This is, right at the beginning of the big Netflix boom when streaming was everywhere. Nobody was renting a DVD. And I thought when I saw the sign that it was one of these places that we have all over the country where the sign is still up, but the store is empty because it costs more money to take the sign down than it's worth. So I drove past that thing for the better part of a year before it ever really occurred to me to stop in and see. And what I was thinking was, oh, maybe I'll see the abandoned store. Maybe the Dropbox will still be there and I'll take a picture for Instagram. Won't that be fun? I'm like a filmmaker. I'm going to an abandoned Blockbuster. That'll be fun. But what I found was, it was like a time warp. I walked in there and it was like nothing had changed since the 90s. It looked the same. It felt the same. It smelled the same. It smelled like, movies and carpet and popcorn and exactly what you remember. And as a, a documentary filmmaker, my curiosity just started going. I was like, what is going on here? How are they still in business? Who is shopping here? That was the biggest shock for me, is that there were still people in there renting movies. It wasn't, like we also had a Radio Shack and you'd go in there and there'd be nobody because nobody needs, one volume knob anymore. We got Amazon. So Radio Shack is pointless, but for some reason there were still all these people, it was crowded. People were renting and it had all the new releases in 2016, 2017. It kind of blew my mind. And like that day in that first visit, I talked to the manager and said, would it be okay if we start bringing cameras around and filming? And there were still a dozen Blockbusters left in the world. They weren't the last one or anything. I was just fascinated. And so while I was working on other movies, I just kept going back, every few weeks, checking in at Blockbuster and seeing what was going on. But that's really how it started. It's just, I couldn't believe there was still a Blockbuster in my town.
And you started this documentary in 2017, am I correct?
Yeah, just about 4 years ago now, the beginning of 2017.
And at that time, you said there were 12 Blockbusters left, so you actually probably had no intention of naming your documentary The Last Blockbuster.
No, that was what they call in the film business, dumb luck. I was in the right place at the right time. And actually, I did at the beginning reach out to all of the other stores. It was only owned by a few people. One person owned all the ones in Alaska and one person owned all the ones in Texas. And, there's only 12 left. It was owned by, I think, four different people. So I contacted everybody and I was going to go around and visit all these remaining Blockbuster videos. And as I was planning to do that and kind of raising money and trying to figure out how am I going to get to Alaska with a film crew, they just started closing. Started dropping like flies. And that just led to me focusing on this one store that I had access to because it was in my town. We were just kind of lucky that the one we had been focusing on from the very beginning ended up being the last one. There's no way we could have planned that or made that happen.
That's crazy. Yeah. Dumb luck, just like you said. And what was it like getting to know the family that owned this last Blockbuster? Were you concerned? I mean, it's obviously a dying breed. It's like a unicorn.
Yeah. So the family that runs it, the owners are separate, but the manager, Sandy, her family has been involved with the store for almost two decades now, since the early 2000s. And her energy and her enthusiasm is infectious. And when you're around her and her family, there almost never is that, oh my God, we're doomed vibe, or like, is it going to close? you know, every once in a while she'd get like a phone call or an email that would be like, hey, your lease is coming up and we're going to have to renegotiate. But for the most part, on a day-to-day basis, you know, she's running that place like, just like I said, like no one told them Blockbuster went out of business, you know? And as they became the last one, you know, she started to get more notoriety and the news would call her all the time and she'd go on talk shows and things. And I think she really has taken ownership of this sort of responsibility. Like, yes, I am the keeper of this thing, you know, and she doesn't take that lightly. She's very proud that they're the last Blockbuster. And so that too is infectious. You know, you kind of get swept up in this vibe of this small town store that is the last one in the world. And they appreciate that, you know, they're not taking that for granted. And it's a really cool vibe. And I think that's part of why they're the last one and why they're still in business. But also, if this had happened to some other store that, you know, wasn't run by somebody like that, who loves the movies and appreciates the, you know, the bigger picture of being the last Blockbuster, I don't think they would have made it. So it's really cool. And meeting Sandy and getting to spend the last 4 years hanging out with her was definitely the best part of making this movie. She's just a fantastic person.
You managed to kind of depict this Blockbuster as a type of sanctuary. If you could talk about some of the decisions you made as a director, I would really be interested in that.
Sure. This project, I had a partner on it named Zeke Cam, who used to be a writer in Hollywood. He wrote on Powerpuff Girls and Dexter's Lab and other great 90s shows like that. And he was really the guy who kept pushing story, you know, and like you said, this, the family aspect. And I, from the beginning, I couldn't quite see that, you know, I was the Blockbuster video nostalgia side of it. So together we really kind of shaped it into what it is, but he was the one who was like, as soon as he met Sandy, he was writing the story outline of, oh my God, this is a family story. This, we've stumbled into something even better than just the history of Blockbuster video, which is interesting on its own. You know, the way they rose to popularity and then crashed so quickly and so hard is fascinating from like a business school standpoint or a, like what not to do. But the family story to me is like the better story of, you know, this woman who's keeping this thing alive. So I give that credit to Zeke, who really like zeroed in on that from the beginning. But as far as the decisions, you know, the filmmaking decisions, we started out with three different story things. You know, we knew we had the story of this local Blockbuster video. We didn't know it was going to be the last one, but we knew you could dive into the small town aspect and how they're still going and who's still renting there. All those questions that popped into my head at the beginning. And then the second part, we knew we had to tell the history of Blockbuster video because you have to put this story in context. And also it's just fascinating and you don't have a last Blockbuster without a first Blockbuster. So that's just kind of storytelling 101. And then the third thing we really wanted to do that I think is kind of more what I brought to it is the sort of celebrity nostalgia thing where we're just talking to people about the experience and the feeling of renting movies. To me, that was the kind of emotional through line of the, like, the big question we kept asking is, what are we losing when you take away this experience? You know, are movies becoming less important to people's lives or less valuable when you don't have to drive to a place and interact with a human, you know, and then get it back and rewind it and all those things? Because there's a lot of really cool documentaries out there about like the VHS tape culture and video renting in general. And there's parts of all of those that I love that I wanted to make sure we included. That's really about, you know, yes, it's nostalgic and, you know, you're doing a podcast about the 90s. So you get it. We're all at that age where the 90s is retro now. And that's still weird to me because I still think it was like a couple of years ago.
Yeah. But, I feel that.
But that was the third aspect that I really thought we could kind of tie everything together is that there was this thing that I would do almost every weekend that was a huge part of my life and everybody's lives, that took, you know, hours. You would drive to a place and you would wander these aisles. And then all of a sudden, without anybody really realizing it, it was just gone. You know, we woke up one day and there just weren't video stores, which that was the third thing I wanted to make sure we conveyed in the movie of like, yes, it's cute that there's one store left and they're still in business and that's great. And the history is fascinating too. But what about the big picture of like, what happened to the DVD? Where did movies go? Like, they're in the cloud. I don't know what the cloud is. I know what a VHS tape is, but I don't know. You know, when I push the button on the Amazon remote and it plays, you know, Pulp Fiction for me, that's nothing. It doesn't exist. It's not an object. So to me, that was a big part of it too, was the movie as an object, as a piece of art. I think that's part of what's going away. And then also the social interaction of going to someplace and talking with somebody about movies. It's like, now there's a computer that says, hey, if you liked Pulp Fiction, you're probably going to like season two of the Great British Baking Show. Like, what? I guess Netflix, I guess.
That's so awesome that you brought up that human aspect, because that's actually one of the reasons why I started this podcast. These kids today, man, I'm really concerned about the lack of necessary human contact that they have in their lives. I mean, it's so easy to just sit on your phone nowadays, and even if it's 30 minutes of picking out a movie, you were guaranteed to hear some talk about movies or some recommendations from other people. And even if you didn't interact with anyone, that's just an infectious vibe that you were kind of alluding to. And that really comes across in the documentary. And that was what really hit home to me.
Yeah, that's, I mean, the younger generation was something that was very hard for us to sort of figure out, like, would they even understand what this movie is? They've never had to rent a DVD or get it back in time. And Zeke, my partner on the film, he has a son who he's 10 or 11 when we started, and he brought him to the store. And this little boy is walking up and down and he sees, you know, there's a kids section, so it's bright colors and all these movies. And he only knows movies from browsing, you know, on Netflix or wherever. That's what kids know. Mm-hmm. So when he went and found a movie and picked it up and then instinctually flipped it over, like we all do, you know, to read the back, and he looks at his dad and he says, Dad, there's stuff on the back. The movie has stuff on the back. And like that moment for me really clicked as like, oh my God, that's something we have to keep in mind, is this movie we made, it's going to be around in 20 years. And for sure, video stores will not be around in 20 years. Netflix might not even be around in 20 years. So, you know, to sort of preserve that, that's why we have a whole bit in the movie that it just explains, yeah, I walk to the store and I pick out the movie and I take it to the counter and they tell me I have late fees and they tell me how many days I have, because there are people, anyone under, God, even like 25 years old now, doesn't remember renting movies. And that's crazy to me, makes me feel old and sad and tired, but also, you know, it's part of why we wanted to make this. It's like, we have documented and preserved what renting a movie is for future generations.
Speaking of those future generations, I have a bunch of old DVDs and particularly VHS tapes. I did a small segment on my first episode about how Pokemon cards have recently come back and they're worth mega bucks right now. Since you're the expert here, would you say that it's possible for VHSs to increase in value coming in the next couple years?
Yeah, I 100% do think that. And we've already seen it. There are some rare VHS tapes. I kind of am keeping up with the underground VHS collectors community, because we just released our movie on VHS and it's kind of a big deal to put out a VHS tape. So you got to tie into these communities. But
that's so
I've started
awesome.
Collecting. I still have a bunch of VHS from my youth that I could never bear to get rid of like the original X-Men cartoon and, you know, Pee-wee's Playhouse and stuff like that. But the Blockbuster here, people have started donating VHS tapes like by the truckload to like help out the store or whatever, but they can't rent them. They don't have the system set up for that. So they just sell them. You know, they have bins of used VHS tapes now, which is fun. And I go there quite a bit for the movie and to visit and check out whatever's going on. And I've been buying VHS tapes at Blockbuster now, and they're only a couple bucks, but some of them have been going up in value. I also recently got into Laserdisc for the first time in my life, which also going up in value and rare. And it's because the physical media doesn't last, and it's a finite thing. Like even a popular movie like Speed or Titanic, that the VHS tapes are everywhere. Yeah, there's 10 million of those, but 6 million of them are in landfills already. And somebody breaks one every day or throws it away in the trash.
That's a good point.
It's just like what happened with trading cards or with anything we collected in the 90s. There was a long period in the early 2000s where it was worthless, right? Like they're just, I've got these Magic the Gathering cards that I thought were going to be worth a fortune. They're not, they're worth nothing. but part of that is because Magic the Gathering is still around and they're still making cards and they've flooded the market. Nobody's making VHS tapes anymore. Certainly no nobody's one. Making Laserdisc. So as there are fewer of them, they go up in value. And the other problem, though, is that they won't last forever. Like the magnetic tape will not work 100 years from now. So there's this window, right, where it's like, oh, it's cool that this copy, this original pressing of Night of the Living Dead is going to be worth more. But eventually it's going to be worth nothing because the plastic's going to disintegrate. So I don't know. I like physical media, but I wouldn't bank on it. I wouldn't invest all your money into VHS tapes.
Got it. Good little financial advice for our viewers out there too. Look at that.
Yeah.
And you bring in a lot of different actors on this documentary. What was it like working with, like, for example, Kevin Smith from Clerks, who's just an absolute legend, Adam Brody? Talk about kind of those experiences and, you know, what Blockbuster, the fact that Blockbuster really means something to these actors is so cool.
Yeah. Well, we started with like a dream list of actors and directors and comedians who we knew either had worked at video stores or, you know, like Doug Benson has a podcast about movies. So we know that they're connected to our themes. And then we just started reaching out. And like you said, they have this passion for Blockbuster Video and for video renting in general. So it wasn't as difficult as it might have been, you know, to get people on board. And then it's just really fun for me. It's my favorite part of my job as a filmmaker is when you're with somebody who loves the same thing you love. And my job is to just talk with them about that thing, you know, like, you and I right now, we're talking about videos and I love that, but I got to do that same thing with Kevin Smith. And I grew up watching his movies. You know, he's part of why I became a filmmaker is because he, you know, Clerks and Mallrats and Chasing Amy and Dogma, those were the movies that seemed accessible. You know, he would famously talk about making them on credit cards for a little bit of money. And as a kid in the 90s, and I, you know, lived in Oregon, nobody was making movies or anything, but I could sort of, the wheels in my head would turn and I would go, yeah, maybe one day it's possible that somebody could do that. And then, you know, people like Adam Brody from the OC, I'm sure he's more well known from other things, but like getting to hang out with people from TV and movies that I love and talk about renting movies that they love. It's just fun. You know, I imagine sometimes it would be very hard for a documentary filmmaker who's making like a hard hitting political documentary and you got to get somebody in there and ask them the tough questions and really dig and, you know, people are mad and people are sad. the only time people were sad in our movie is when we told them there weren't any blockbusters left. And it was a nostalgic kind of sad, you know, it wasn't a real, you know, no puppies were injured.
Yeah. We like to keep it light here on Behind the 90s. I don't know if I could ever do anything like, you know, political or, you know, anything like that.
It's too hard.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But I mean, for me, like emotionally, I don't want to have those conversations. I appreciate that people are doing it. You know, I love a good true crime documentary, but I'm not interviewing somebody whose child was murdered or something. That's no, thank you. Let me have the pop culture from the 90s and you can figure out who killed JonBenet.
Exactly. Yeah. I'd rather do a whole podcast on the smell you get when you walk into Blockbuster exactly. rather than the investigative journalism.
Yeah.
And you also got to talk to probably my favorite interview in this whole, in the whole
documentary. I already know which one you're talking about.
I don't know if you do. Because I'm kind of weird. I got a weird sense of taste.
All right.
I'm going to say the CFO, Tom Casey.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. So he has a great quote and he says it was always more of an experience than just getting a DVD. I would love to know what it was like getting to know him and kind of like, obviously at one point business was absolutely booming.
Yeah.
And the fact that he, you know, that he went through that struggle as someone who, you know, was running the show. I can't imagine that, man. What did you get from him?
He's an interesting cat because, you know, he's very aware of the missteps and the sort of big corporate blunders that Blockbuster went through, but, you know, he wasn't the CEO. He wasn't necessarily in charge of some of those decisions, but he was there for him. So, to us, he was like the perfect guy to, you know, convey those stories. And it was interesting because he kind of, to me, comes across a little bit like a villain in the movie. Like there's parts where he's just like, I don't know who would rent a movie now. Who cares? It's I don't rent movies, whatever. And it's like that kind of corporate vibe that I kind of expected from people. But it's fascinating to me because Blockbuster, you know, at the time it was like Starbucks or Walmart, you know, it was the biggest thing in movie renting. So you know, his perspective, it almost has nothing to do with movies, which was fascinating of like, how can you be so involved with the biggest movie renting chain that ever was and that ever will be? Because there's not going to be a new one. And you still, you know, you're thinking about it in terms of like, and then we changed CEOs and then it was, you know, we sold cell phones for a while and that didn't work. And you're just thinking in numbers and I mean, he's CFO, so he's thinking in numbers, but, we saw that with also the owners of the store here and the Alaska stores, Ken and Alan, who are also in the movie. And it's all these people to whom movies are a business and they're so separated from, you know, they don't care whether it's When Harry Met Sally or Gremlins 2, they just care how many units that they rent, you know, that kind of thing. Whereas me and also Sandy, who manages the store, we come at it from this like love of movies of like, I almost can't believe that the people at those top levels were so disconnected from the art that was making all this money. Because in the 90s, in the 80s through 2008 or so, when Blockbuster was so big, to me, it was always all about the movies. But to know that all the people in charge, it was just, you know, how many bags of popcorn can we sell and how many Twizzlers? And it kind of breaks some of the mystique of it all to know that the people pulling the strings really didn't care whether Titanic was good or not. Just, you know, how many copies can we sell to these silly kids?
Yeah. And just think that was a business where people were coming through a door. Imagine the disconnect, you know, when you have Netflix and Quibi and these thousands of different streaming services, they don't care at all if the movie is good or not, or right. if the user can really get a good recommendation. You know, I don't, that's one thing that you brought that up earlier, and it's a funny idea how a computer is using an algorithm to tell me what I like. And yes, sometimes it works, but like, I think that any normal human being would much rather go off of, oh, my friend told me to watch this. My friend is cool. Therefore, this must be a cool movie. The simple.
Yeah. And you see more of that these days. In fact, the platforms are trying to do more of that as marketing, but they want more than anything, a filmmaker, and me included. What we want is for you to go on your Twitter or your Facebook and tell people that you liked our movie, because that is the best advertising. It's better than a Super Bowl commercial. If you can get people talking about your thing, it's exactly what you're saying. Is what you want to know is what movie did your friends like? And I've been on, 200 Zoom calls in the last year because it's a pandemic and I still want to be social. And I think almost all of them that aren't podcasts, there's a part where we talk about, hey, so what movies have you been watching? What TV have you been watching? Because I don't trust the algorithm. Nobody does. But I trust, my mother-in-law. What have you been watching? Oh, okay. Well, I know what your taste is like, so I might like that. I might not like that. But you talk to your friends. It's like, if somebody sees something good, that's still word of mouth is the only way to really get a sense. And that gives me hope of like, we're not totally headed down a computer garbage disposal where we just listen to robots and all that, because like you said, we still value that human interaction just a little bit more.
Yeah, absolutely. And don't get me started on the AI and the computer, because I'm going to go to a dark place, man. I don't like where it's going. Let's put it that way.
But yeah, I think in the last couple of months, I've been much more into looking at directors I like and going back and watching all their old movies, which was one of my favorite things about the video store. Blockbuster didn't do it this way, but the local video stores would often sort it by like, here's the Quentin Tarantino section, and here's the Kevin Smith section, and here's the Coppola section. And I always thought that was cool because that's a unique way to appreciate the art and the artist. You know, it's like you go into a museum and they'll have the Da Vinci area. They don't just split them up and be like, these are all the paintings of cows. Whereas at the video store, it's like, here's all the movies that are funny and here's all the movies that are, scary. And they're in these sections. But I also like, here's all the movies made by this person, from this place. Yeah. Here's all the Spike Lee movies. They're going to have a same point of view. And Blockbuster never really did that. But all the cool mom and pop video stores I would go to would have these sections that I thought were really cool.
That's an awesome idea. If Netflix or one of these streaming services would organize their movies by director, that would really kind of bring that more to light. Like I love Ridley Scott or, all the big name directors. If that's kind of like, I would compare it to picking a coach. For an NFL team, like if I'm betting football, I usually choose what coach is better, not necessarily what team. And a lot of people kind of forget about those directors that are making the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Are there any directors from a documentary standpoint that influence you?
I took the Ken Burns masterclass, but I don't like Ken Burns documentaries.
Got you.
I like Michael Moore documentaries, but I'm never going to be like the guy in front of the camera, like, look at me, I'm making a movie. So I don't know. Tonally, I like, what's his name? Spurlock, Morgan Spurlock. But he's also one of those, look at me, I'm in my own movie documentary makers.
Yeah, I got you.
Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I like a lighthearted, fun, indie, comedic documentary. So I'm just really pulling bits and pieces from lots of different places. But I mean, I like to think I'm more influenced by non-documentary filmmaker, you know, like the Tarantinos and the Kevin Smiths, and I make narrative stuff too, just short films, and I'm writing a bunch of scripts now. So, you know, I don't love the distinction between documentary and narrative. It's all just movies. It's all entertainment. And there's parts in The Last Blockbuster that are scripted, and, you know, we got out the puppets and we did a scene and we did reenactments and things like that. And it's the same filmmaking as if you're making, you know, a regular romantic comedy or something. So I don't know. I'm influenced by all movies and all pop culture, and I like all of it.
Yeah. That's very interesting. I would never think that a documentary maker would come at it as if it's a script for a more a narrative movie. That's so awesome. Wow. I don't really have any filmmaking experience besides my high school class that I took, but nice. It's very interesting to me. I hope to, you know, one day maybe be in one or make one, to be honest. I've always been into acting and that creative side, and I love movies, obviously. That's fantastic, man. That's awesome stuff. All right, brother. So I'm going to go one last question. We're going to end it on a light note. Okay.
I love it.
Like I said before, I'm not an investigative journalist. We're just keeping it light. All right. So this is when me and my friends always did this one when we went out of Blockbuster. We'd pick our movies and then we'd on the ride home. It's a weird question, but we always asked it to each other. So you're stranded on a desert island. The desert island very weirdly has a VHS or a DVD player, a TV. You got three movies for the rest of your life, or however long you're going to be on the island. What are you going with? I know it's a tough one.
It's a tough one because, I mean, so I kind of lived that in the late 90s, early 2000s. I lived out in the country and didn't have cable, and internet was still dial-up speeds. And I had three DVDs, a DVD player, and a TV. So just every night I would watch the same movies. And it was The Matrix, Gladiator, and I think something about Mary. And it's just because that's what I had. But that's not what I would choose, certainly, because I spent years watching those three already. Great movies.
Hey, those are three where, like, if I'm going to be stuck with three, those are pretty good three, man. I mean,
yeah. And it was just because DVD was brand new and everybody got The Matrix, right? That was the DVD to get, test out your surround sound. But nowadays, I think if I could pick, I would go with Back to the Future 2, which is my favorite of the three.
Nice.
And because it revisits the first movie in the second half, you kind of get a twofer there. I think I would go with the first Star Wars. Even though Empire is my favorite, it doesn't work as well without the other movies. You know, it's not a standalone like the first one is. And then my all-time go-to feel-good popcorn movie is a lesser-known Tom Hanks film called That Thing You Do from 1996. It's a comedy about a one-hit wonder band from the 60s that was directed by Tom Hanks. And has some of the best music in it, and it just makes me feel good every time I watch it.
I've never heard of that one. I'm going to write it down right now and I'm going to watch it because
it's great.
I have a feeling it's going to be awesome. He's so good. I watch everything Tom Hanks has made, or, well, I obviously haven't seen that one, but yeah. The guy doesn't miss. Name one bad Tom Hanks movie. No one can do it. Can't be done. It's impossible. Done.
Nope.
The Thing You Do, that's what it's called.
That Thing You Do. I think he wrote it and directed it, and he wrote a lot of the music in it too. But it's a real fun music. Steve Zahn is in it, and
he's Liv hilarious. Tyler.
It's a good one.
Well, sir, thank you for being on the show. I really hope you enjoyed it. I enjoyed having you.
It's good times.
My first documentary filmmaker that I've ever interviewed. So thank you so much. We are here. We are keeping it 90s. Thank you so much for being on the show, sir.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of Behind the 90s. Make sure to like us on social media at Behind the 90s. Also, we are now moving to new episodes every Monday. That's right, Mondays used to suck. Not anymore, folks. Behind the 90s will be new every Monday. Can't wait to get those episodes out to you. Keep liking, subscribing, throwing those comments down. Feel free to shoot me a DM too on Instagram if you want to be on the show or if we did something that you loved. I really like hearing from all of our wonderful fans across the world. Thank you very much. Thank you for keeping it real and keeping it 90s. See you next week.